Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2004. It's my pleasure to introduce first Warren Olney, who is a veteran broadcast journalist. Warren is the host and executive producer of To the Point, a fast-paced, news-based, one-hour daily national program that focuses on the hot-button issues of the day. The show is a co-production of KCRW 89.9 FM and Public Radio International. Since June 1992, Warren has been the host and executive producer of KCRW's signature daily news public affairs program, Which Way LA, which has been honored with nearly 40 national, regional, and local awards for broadcast excellence since its inception. Concurrent with his hosting duties on Which Way LA from June 99 to September 2000, Warren served as co-anchor of LA Public Television station KCET's Life and Times Tonight, a nightly public affairs show. He is the only person to have been twice named Broadcast Journalist of the Year for his work in both radio and television by the Society of Professional Journalists Los Angeles, and he is the recipient of Emmy Awards for reporting and anchoring and Golden Mics for investigative reporting. He's the voice we trust and the person we turn to when we seek a deeper understanding of the issues that confront us daily in Southern California and in the world. It's always a great pleasure and an honor to have his participation in forums at the Los Angeles Public Library. Please welcome Warren Olney and Chalmers Johnson. Warren will introduce him. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Louise, and thanks to the Library Foundation, and thanks to you for all coming out on a rainy night to see an extraordinary man. I know that you will not be disappointed by this performance this evening. I have, since I started doing radio broadcasts in 1992, I've probably conducted about 10 or 12,000 interviews, something along those lines, because every program has a lot of interviews on it. And we do everything by phone. Those who are repeaters I get to know on a sort of telephone basis. Chalmers Johnson is one of those, and so it's a real privilege and pleasure for me to have met him tonight for the first time and to be here, even though we have talked together many times on the radio and then off the radio as well, but again, only by phone. One of the problems we have with Chalmers is that on our program we try to balance each broadcast with the people who have different points of view about whatever the topic of the day may be. And we try to balance them in every way. And it's very difficult to find somebody to balance with Chalmers. But by that I mean that a person who is so relentlessly logical, so wonderfully persuasive in the way he argues, so articulate, and so well-informed. So fortunately, we didn't have to balance him today. I don't have to argue with him. I'm just going to ask him questions. But I'm delighted to be able to do it. The latest book, of course, is The Sorrows of Empire. And the empire involved, needless to say, is the empire of the United States, which he argues has been brought into existence and operated without the real awareness or understanding of the American people, who nonetheless are the ones who are supporting it. As you can imagine, it's not a book that's full of a lot of laughs. And in fact, in the prologue, he says, this is not an optimistic report. And I think that may be the only understatement in 400 pages of material in The Sorrows of Empire. He says later that I fear that we will lose our country, and then apologizes lest that be an overstatement, but says he thinks he will be forgiven by future generations if it is an overstatement, because they'll be so glad that he was wrong. So I must say that I hope you're wrong. But nonetheless, the arguments are persuasive and are interesting, and let us get to them. But let me begin this way. I don't know if people know your background well, and it's important, I think, to what you have written, particularly given the fact that the military and the CIA are both instruments of the empire that Chalmers describes. And he has been in both the military and the CIA at least, as an advisor. And I think it's his experiences there that have had a lot to do with the ideas that have now evolved into the book, The Sorrows of Empire. So let's begin there. Tell us a bit about your experience in the military, about your experience with the CIA, and how they were formative to what we see in the book.
Warren, it's a great pleasure to put name and face together. It really is, to have a chance to appear here in the Los Angeles Public Library in this forum. Yes, I was in the Navy in the Korean War. I was the operations officer on a rust bucket, the LST 883, hauling Marines around Korea and places like that. This was important to me because it was my first introduction to East Asian civilization. I began studying Japanese at the naval base in Yokosuka. I returned to Berkeley and studied Chinese and spent my life working on the politics of China and Japan. I was a cold warrior. I did believe that the Soviet Union was a genuine menace. And in 1967, I was then the chairman of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. I was recruited by Richard Helms, then the director of CIA, soon to be indicted for lying to Congress over the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile. He claimed that we had nothing to do with it. Of course, we had everything to do with it. I was in the Office of National Estimates, which are now in the news again. They're extremely highly classified papers that go to the president. They're classified primarily because they are so unbelievably banal, it would be an embarrassment to the American public to realize the quality of this is what passes for strategic thought in the Oval Office, nonetheless, it was a formative experience. One anecdote from those days. I do remember that as Daniel Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers began to be published in the New York Times, there was literally cheering in the halls of Langley, as the people who had worked on Vietnam said, finally, we no longer look like such a group of fools. We've been saying for a long time that the war was unwinnable, and we had enormous respect for Ellsberg. He was, as we used to say, one of us. He was a Marine officer. He had served in Vietnam. He had a PhD in economics from Harvard. He was a RAND Corporation character. My God, it was easy to give him a security clearance. I just had a pleasant conversation with him not too long ago, and he was saying that he wished he'd acted earlier. But what you're wondering is, well, what many people say to me, things like, when did you stop being a bloodlusting fascist hyena?
you said that. I didn't ask that question.
That wasn't his question. But just to put it very briefly, there were two certainly formative influences, one analytical and the other quite concrete. With the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, I believe that we should have seen a much greater peace dividend, a withdrawal from our huge deployments around the world. The menace of the Soviet Union was gone. The Cold War was clearly over. Russia is a much smaller country than the former Soviet Union used to be. Instead, our government moved at once, even before Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, moved at once to try and find replacement enemies and to shore up the Cold War structures in Latin America, in East Asia. I believe this posed a major analytic question. Was the Cold War a cover for something more fundamental, for an American imperial project that probably went back to World War II, in which we used anti-communism as a cover for essentially imperialist activities? It was extremely convenient to us in Latin America. We've used Fidel Castro for years to cover what were, in fact, activities undertaken for the sake of the United Fruit Company, or of Anaconda Copper Company, or something of that sort. So that I set out to investigate that. The concrete experience was a visit to Okinawa in 1996. This is the southernmost Japanese province, prefecture. It's the poorest prefecture in Japan. It has 38 American military bases located on an island smaller than Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands. It is the Japanese equivalent of Puerto Rico. It has been seized by the Japanese Empire at the end of the 19th century, discriminated against ever since, and essentially used today as a dumping ground for American troops. They'd like to maintain the Japanese-American Security Treaty, but they don't want the 3rd Marine Division located anywhere close to them. On September 4th, 1995, an extremely serious incident occurred. Two Marines and a sailor from Camp Hansen, a big, ugly base in the middle of Okinawa, had abducted, beaten, and raped a 12-year-old girl. It produced the largest demonstrations against the United States since the security treaty was signed. I was invited by the governor of Okinawa to come to Okinawa in February 1996 to talk to his staff about this incident, and I did so, and I was truly shocked by what I saw, by the as well as the fact that the then the commandant of American forces in East Asia was General Richard Myers. He is today, of course, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He took the standard routine way of dealing with these issues to say, well, this is an exceptional, tragic incident, three bad apples, but in no way typical of our troops. My research, including research published just quite recently, has demonstrated that the rate of sexually violent crimes leading to court-martial in Okinawa has for 50 years averaged at 2 a month. There was nothing, the only thing exceptional about the rape of 1995 was that they raped a child instead of a mature woman who very often they depend upon the fact that she would be so humiliated she wouldn't come forward anyway. My first reaction was that Okinawa must be exceptional, that this place is just nobody's paid attention to it. The military is extremely skilled in public relations. The press never goes down there. The Japanese don't encourage you to go down there. After I began to investigate our big American military enclaves in the Persian Gulf, in Diego Garcia, in South Korea, in Japan, in Germany, England, Italy, I discovered that Okinawa was not exceptional. It was typical. That is, around what Americans don't appreciate is that foreigners, commonly the Americans they see, are not representatives of our popular culture or of our movies or whatever else that we're sometimes proud of. What they see are 18 to 24-year-old young men, usually in the special forces, in well over 130 countries around the world. And these people live with continuous sexual violence, noise pollution, environmental pollution, bar brawls, drunk driving, one thing after another. I would simply conclude by saying there are no foreign troops based in the United States. So unless you have lived next door to one of these bases abroad, you don't know anything about what goes on with next to them.
I'm not in a position to argue with you, of course, and or dispute your research, but what reason does the military give for having these bases in so many countries around the world?
They don't actually give a reason. The base structure report, published each year by the Department of Defense, lists, at the time of this book, 2002, 725 military bases located in other people's countries. That's, believe me, considerably more than we need for any conceivable strategic purpose. 725 is also just the official number. They leave out all the secret bases, the espionage bases, the bases in England that are disguised as Royal Air Force bases, the three bases in Israel that are highly secret. They never mention the bases in Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Camp Bonsteel in Kosovo. They don't mention the four bases being built as we talk in Iraq places like that. These bases came into being in the course of fighting one or another of our various wars. We almost never give one up when the war is over. We start then finding new uses for it, new... the only time we give them up is after we lost a war. After Vietnam, we did lose our bases in Spain, in Greece, and in the Philippines, simply because they decided, their governments, that it wasn't so useful to be allied or to be tolerant of the American bases. But the justification is essentially strategic needs in... without ever saying so in so many words, to maintain American hegemony over the globe.
American hegemony or stability in various parts of the world? What's the difference?
Stability is an odd term. I know they love it. That's the kind of word they started to use when they were looking for a replacement for the Soviet Union. Teachers of international relations say by the very nature of the international system, it is unstable. The issue is never stability. The issue is whether the stability is of any importance to our country, the instability, where it may or may not occur. So they claim that they're also maintaining stability, but at the same time, I mean, for example, Secretary Rumsfeld was just recently in Okinawa and said to the governor that the bases there were justified by the stability that we had brought to the area without over 50 years, without ever mentioning either the Korean or Vietnamese wars that had occurred throughout this period, in which Okinawa was a major launching area for these things, or all the other numerous smaller incidents like East Timor or whatever else. It's not clear that in any sense our extremely high-tech military brings stability to anything. It may very well produce the opposite, and it certainly produces anti-Americanism.
Are we not protecting regimes that are allied with us for various purposes?
The military actually prefers regimes that are not democratic. That is, they're, in fact, one of the specific justifications today for the removal of the bases from Germany into places, poor former communist countries like Romania and Bulgaria, is that the Germans demand much higher standards of environmental protection than they do, and the military has said in so many words, we can be dirty in these countries. The status of forces agreements that we impose on all countries exempt us from ever cleaning up the messes that we make. In some cases, we are dealing with allies, but let's take Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, part of the military petroleum complex and our attempts to bring the oil of the Caspian Basin under our control. We've built military bases there. One of them is called the Captain Peter J. Gunsey Jr. Air Force Base. Peter J. Gunsey is the highest ranking fireman in the New York Fire Department who lost his life on 9/11. The Russians have now just built a new base 40 miles away. It's the first military base Russia has built since the collapse of the Soviet Union. They're clearly trying to balance us. The governments of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan are probably as right-wing, authoritarian, old apparatchiks left over from the Soviet Union as you could find. I mean, that is, our president loves to go out of his, he's been quoted by Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, how he loathes Kim Jong-il of North Korea. These two guys make Kim Jong-il look like a fairly decent neighbor. And they've both been welcomed to the Oval Office. It always reminds me that when he said he loathed Kim Jong-il of North Korea, it always crossed my mind. George Bush and Kim Jong-il do have one thing in common. Neither of them would be where they are without their daddies. Neither of them could conceivably have risen above a gas station attendant without that. It's not at all clear that the United States has an almost impeccable record in East Asia of sponsoring anti-democratic regimes, of bringing military officers to power. That one of our greatest allies on earth today is General Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan, who, after all, came to power in the Clinton administration through a military overthrow of a democratically elected government. We have laws that are supposed to keep us from participating with such people. So that, yes, you may say that we are, in a certain sense, protecting our allies, and it did make sense at one time during the Cold War when we were a status quo power attempting to build an edifice of legality, of international law, of the United Nations, the use of foreign aid in as a tool of diplomacy, something we pioneered. But we were doing this against the revisionist powers, the powers that were trying to change the world, like Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan or Mao's China or the Soviet Union. Today, I think you would have to say that we are, without question, the most revisionist of revisionist powers. We openly proclaim we are the new Rome. We are beyond good and evil. We are beyond the need for friends. We are beyond the need for the United Nations. Paul Wolfowitz, that is the Assistant Secretary of Defense, virtually uses the old Roman phrase, we do not care whether they love us so long as they fear us. This is... So in that sense, I find it stretching a point to say that we are doing this for the benefit of anyone else.
You've excoriated and made fun of the current president, but obviously you think this goes back to previous administrations as well. When did it go wrong? When did things go wrong, according to your
good question.
View?
I mean, precisely. This book is not particularly an anti-Bush book. I mean, I wouldn't want to kid you. This is, in the Chinese calendar, the year of the monkey, and I'd vote for a monkey to replace the current government.
I want to say Chalmers Johnson's views are his and not those of the management.
Well, absolutely.
Necessarily.
We have a free exchange of ideas in the Los Angeles Public Library. I think the critical mistake, I believe, mistake in the Talleyrand sense of fundamental, irreparable strategic error, was in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And bear in mind, it happened rapidly. We didn't anticipate it. The CIA radically overestimated the size of the Soviet economy in the 1980s. I mean, if we were having this conversation in 1985 and I had said to you, 5 years from now, the Soviet Union will disappear, you would have thought, this guy's inhaling too deeply on something grown around the Berkeley campus. I mean, this is not a reliable commentator. Well, it's gone. It came apart for forces that are also influencing us in this country today, too. That is, in 1991, we concluded wrongly that we had won the Cold War. We simply didn't lose it as badly as they did because we were richer than they were and it took us longer to do so. We had absolutely nothing we did had anything to do with the collapse of the Soviet Union, least of all Reagan's Star Wars. We know that in detail. Gorbachev brought Sakharov into the Politburo to describe how to defeat an anti-ballistic missile defense, and he gave a brilliant exposition, and they spent not a ruble on it. This was an error. We concluded now, in virtually the words of Paul Wolfowitz in the original draft of what is now today the National Security Document of September 2002, but that was first written in the last years of the first Bush administration, that our policy now is to maintain absolute dominance over the world militarily, ultimately from bases in outer space, and this is to keep under control everyone. That is, not enemies, every source of power, including allies, that might ultimately compete with us. This, I think, is a kind of hubris, a kind of arrogance, a kind of unreality that begins to, it separates us away from the rest of the world. We like many people in Washington, at least in the Pentagon, do like this phrase, the new Rome. We're beginning to behave like the Roman Empire. And with I mentioned this simply, of course, the Roman Empire, it took 300 years to fall. The collapse of empires is now starting to come sort of with the speed of FedEx. The Thousand-Year Reich lasted 12 years, from 1933 to the sack of Berlin in 1945 by the Red Army. The Soviet Union's empire fell apart between 1989 and 1991. Ours is may well be beyond the Rubicon already, as it is, in terms of imperial overstretch. But I think this is when we started to go wrong, was when we concluded that, wrongly, that we had won the Cold War and were therefore no longer, there were no longer challenges or threats to us from the rest of the world in any military sense.
You just used the term overstretch. What about the fact that many in the military apparently now are very concerned that we are overstretched in terms of our military capability and not likely to be able to do much about it with a volunteer army and reserves now being used up? It's my understanding there are a lot of people in the Pentagon very, very concerned about that, who feel that the war in Iraq was a misjudged effort.
No question about that. I mean, it is one of the great restraints on our empire that now is starting to show up. Where do we get the cannon fodder? It's not been an obligation of citizenship to defend the country since 1973. It is a career choice. It is not, those of you who are veterans of World War II or Korea or Vietnam simply wouldn't recognize life in the armed forces today. It's a you don't do KP anymore. You don't clean latrines. That's all farmed out to companies like Kellogg Brown and Root, subsidiary of Cheney's Halliburton, very lucratively, because you've got to make life in the armed forces attractive. It starts to develop a. Moreover, people join the military today largely because. Or in many cases, they do so to escape one or another dead end of our society. That's why African Americans are twice as well represented in the Army as they are in the society as a whole. 50% of the women in the armed forces are national minorities. I thought it was telling when PFC Jessica Lynch was wounded at Nasiriyah and the press asked her why'd she join the Army. She says, I couldn't get a job at Walmart in Palestine, West Virginia. It was my way out. I joined the Army to get out of Palestine, West Virginia. The important point, she didn't expect to be shot. And most of the people joining the Army do not expect to be shot at. And that is one of the great restraints we have on the armed forces right now, is we will see in a very short period of time whether you can continue to attract sufficient numbers of people into the armed forces to fulfill our imperial plans, or whether we have to go to something very politically loaded like a draft, or probably in the back of most of the planners' minds is a traditional imperialist strategy, start looking for foreign cannon fodder, sepoys. You did that in Vietnam with Montagnards and Hmong people and things like that. We're certainly trying it today, trying to attract alleged coalition partners like the Japanese or the Dutch or the Poles or whatever to send troops to Iraq. It is, of course, the danger in that strategy is, are they loyal? I mean, when we use the word sepoys, well, that was the Sepoy Rebellion of 1857 in India. Most of the British Army in India were made up of Indian troops, and when they revolted, it became well known in Indian history, the first movement of liberation of India from British imperialism. But it's a major constraint of whether we will run out of the manpower and woman power today to staff the empire, as well as the fact that it's unimaginably expensive.
When other countries are willing to send troops for whatever purpose, to Iraq or any place else where we have where we are engaged, isn't that an indication of international support for whatever it is that is being done? Doesn't it validate the policy, as is so often argued? If we could only get the UN to be more involved with Iraq, have troops from other countries, as the Democratic candidates have been advocating. Then we'll have a kind of validity and an acceptance in that part of the world that we simply don't now.
Well, that's what the White House would like you to believe, and says it on the evening news owned by the entertainment conglomerates. But the truth of the matter is, people cooperate with us because of the threat of retaliation, because of the fear that a country as powerful as ours is, with the major international economic institutions, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and the International Monetary Fund, as the demonstrators in Seattle in November 1999 showed to the rest of the world, these are among the most anti-democratic, not undemocratic, anti-democratic institutions that exist on Earth, and they're completely under the thumb of the U.S. Treasury. They can be used, if need be, to even just the threat of their being used is enough to cause most countries to come along with us. The thing that is astonishing to me today is that two such powerful countries as France and Germany should have decided to stand aloof, that countries that could have avoided our might makes right adventure in Iraq, Japan, Britain, Australia, they've actually are isolating themselves badly. I mean, one of the results of what's happened in Iraq is that Britain simply will never for decades have influence on the continent again. They're not trusted any longer. You could get rid of Tony Blair, but indeed it's stuck around the world that Blair is Bush's poodle and Koizumi is his Cocker Spaniel. These people understand the nature of power in the world. At the same time, there is growing inevitably, because of the openness of the administration in its dropping of its mask and what it wants to do, compared with the world of Bill Clinton, where he protected himself by putting it under globalization or humanitarian intervention or some other rubric that suggested it wasn't simply American policy to maintain hegemony over the world, but that now we have this situation of openness that has started to lead to, I mean, a year ago, in February of 2003, 10 million people in every democracy on earth demonstrated against the Bush administration, the war in Iraq, and for democracy. 400,000 in New York, 2 million in London, the largest demonstration in British history, 1 million each in Berlin, Madrid, Rome. Those people haven't gone away. Their organization today is virtually a guarantee of it's as if a new superpower were rising to thwart the ambitions of the United States. I recommend to all of you that you read Arundhati Roy's brilliant speech to the World Social Forum that just closed in Bombay. She calls her speech, "Do the Turkeys Enjoy Thanksgiving?" what she's basically talking about is that peculiar American custom now of the president sparing a single turkey for a happy life in a Virginia farm and while we eat the rest of them. And she regards this as a metaphor for America's attitudes toward the third world. But she ends her speech. I mean, it is the winner of the Booker Prize, and she fascinates me because she says things nobody else ever says, and the moment she says it, they become common knowledge. But she ends by saying, "I'm tired of demonstrating. I want to boycott these people on everywhere they are, everything they produce, everything that happens." A boycott that just starts off with 10 million people is a restraint on a country like ours. So that it's not as though, maybe we are the new Rome, but our decline has started fairly rapidly.
You talked about the Clinton administration and said that it had been shielded in certain ways, or that President Clinton shielded himself from what is essentially the same kind of thing that the Bush administration is doing. What about the Balkans and Kosovo? Why on earth would we want to be concerned about that part of the world? What interest do we have there?
It's a wonderful question. Delighted to answer it. That is to say, Bill Clinton said we'd only be there for 6 months. The current president campaigned on the idea that we shouldn't be there at all, that what is this peacekeeping operation to protect the Kosovar Albanians from Serbs? Well, there's a base there called Camp Bondsteel. It's not listed in the base structure report. The Army proudly says there are only two man-made objects you can see from outer space, the Great Wall of China and Camp Bondsteel. It was built in 1999, the richest base we've built since the Vietnam War. It was built by Kellogg Brown and Root of Halliburton. It lies directly athwart the proposed pipeline across the Balkans that Kellogg Brown and Root have already also surveyed. That is the plan. We had a coup d'etat just a few weeks ago in Georgia to make sure that we have a friendly government there as we begin to extract oil from the Caspian Sea, move it through Georgia to the Black Sea, across the Black Sea to Bulgaria, and then across the Balkans to the Adriatic coast in Albania, avoiding the Bosporus and Dardanelles that are too narrow. They limit ships to 150,000 tons going through there. Camp Bondsteel lies directly athwart this pipeline and is part of what we call the military petroleum complex. Today we are motivated to maintain our profligate use of fossil fuels and have refused to conserve in any way, even though we've had the technology for some time, to eliminate entirely our dependence on Persian Gulf oil. The symbol of the United States after 9/11 in Europe became some sort of youthful lout driving a Chevrolet Suburban down the freeways with a American flag attached to his antenna. I think the Suburban gets about 11 miles to the gallon. Its sales doubled in the years after 9/11. Extremely profitable product for General Motors. It's a choice we use more petroleum than anybody else does. We also think that we can exercise control over potential sources of power in the future, such as China. It grew at 9.1% last year. It is easily the fastest growing large economy on Earth today. That we can use oil to control them in the future. So that is, we are looking at the whole southern Eurasian world opened up by the collapse of the Soviet Union, from the Balkans to China. As it stands right now, with our positions in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as in Central Asia, we have only Iran stands in the way. Therefore, it's not accidental that it appears on the axis of evil. I've actually traveled in this part of the world. I've swum in the Caspian Sea. It has a distinctly oily smell to it. When I did it, it was back in Brezhnev's days. It was better known for sturgeon and caviar. But Baker Botts, the firm of the great Republican Secretary of State, Jim Baker, has a law office in Baku, Azerbaijan. There's not too much legal business to do in Baku. The American ambassador to Kazakhstan, very pleasant, extremely well-educated woman, drove her car around the capital of Kazakhstan with a bumper strip on it that said, "Happiness is twin pipelines." She was thinking of the pipelines across Afghanistan from Tajikistan for the Union Oil Company the Arabian Sea in Pakistan. We're in the Balkans for oil politics, not to save Kosovars.
What would you say to an American who said, okay, if in fact we have this kind of hegemony over the rest of the world, if we can exert this kind of power, if we can engineer a coup d'etat in Georgia or anyplace else, and feed ourselves and our way of living at the same time and do so without a fear of attack by anybody, why shouldn't we?
Sit back and enjoy it, yes. Well, this is the reason I've written this book. It's a sequel to a book that I published in the year 2000 called Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. Blowback is a CIA term. It means retaliation, obviously. It first was used in the after-action report on the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953 for the sake of the British Petroleum Company. We accused him of being a communist. The Pope would probably fit that category more accurately than Mohammed Mossadegh did. We brought the Shah to power, notoriously. But I conclude by... what I'm trying to do in this book is to lay out a vast amount of information in what I hope is a readable manner that I'm reasonably certain Americans don't have, and they desperately need to have it. They need to know about the base world. They need to know about the interests there. They need to understand what George Washington was talking about in his farewell address when he warned against the influence of standing armies, what Dwight Eisenhower was talking about in his farewell address in 1961, when he invented the phrase military-industrial complex. He meant to say military-industrial congressional complex, we know from his papers, but was warned off from doing that. We may have already crossed the Rubicon. It may be irreversible. A genuine American hero like Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia continues to give these impassioned and intelligent and informed speeches, knowledgeable of American history, in empty Senate chambers. He's our Cicero. I think, will by our society just be ignored as an old man from a poor state. Cicero ended up with his head and both hands nailed to the Forum wall by the then boy emperor Octavian, soon to become the god Augustus Caesar. And to institute military dictatorship. My four sorrows that I end with, and why I stress this, are perpetual war. The president and the vice president have identified between 50 and 60 countries they would like to do regime change in using our military. Secondly, the loss of...
They've done that publicly.
Yes, they've done that publicly, yes. It was that Cheney first said 50, and then in the West Point speech, Bush raised him to 60. The second is the loss of the republic. It is the irreversible damage to the Constitution. I mean, the most important author of the Constitution, James Madison, wrote under the name Publius, used referring to our Roman antecedents, in the Federalist Papers, that the single most important article in the Constitution was the one that gave the power to declare war exclusively to the elected representatives of the people. Never under any circumstances should it be entrusted to a single man. The responsibility was too great. In October of 2002, our Congress gave that power to a single man on his say-so, when he felt like it, including the use of nuclear weapons if he cares to do so, and it helped sell the Congress by creating a false national intelligence estimate on Iraq in the same month that was passed to Congress, essentially a national intelligence estimate in which the CIA was ordered to find the evidence to back up the speeches that Vice President Cheney has already given. Now, as we talk, Articles 4 and 6 of the Bill of Rights are dead letters. You do not have, that is to say, the president has invented a new category known as, and I'm not kidding you, and I'm not being sarcastic, it is known as bad guy. And if the president declares you a bad guy, he, even though you're a native-born citizen, he can throw you in a naval brig in Charleston, South Carolina, and keep you there. We're about soon to find in the next few months whether or not the Supreme Court that appointed this president would care to address these issues. We're talking about very serious incidents here. The third of my sorrows of empire is disinformation. It is lying to the public by the government. Probably the most serious example we've had, it goes on every day with weapons of mass destruction, so-called, but it was February 5th last year. The Secretary of State, Colin Powell, in the UN Security Council, with the Director of Central Intelligence sitting like a potted plant behind him, so that his face appeared in any television picture, allegedly providing verisimilitude, trying to recreate the scene in the Security Council when Adlai Stevenson came in with the YouTube pictures of the Russian missiles in Cuba, precipitating the Cuban Missile Crisis when we offered our evidence to the world. We now know that everything Colin Powell said that day was a lie, and he had ample reason to know it was, that it was manufactured and wrong. There is not a serious, informed statesman on earth today that would believe a word said by the Secretary of State of the United States. He's lost all credibility. But this is the cost of this kind of thing. But fourth, and perhaps most obvious that we face, is bankruptcy. When you have spending $500 billion a year on the military, $400 billion defense budget, leaving aside Iraq and Afghanistan, plus at least another $20 billion in the Department of Energy for atomic energy, it comes out to about $500 billion a year. We can't afford that. We're not funding it. We're going deeply into debt. As Herbert Stein, when he was a Republican, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, once put it, things that can't go on forever don't. That's what's happening. Even if the American public is willing to kiss off their Constitution, the economic crisis is likely to catch up with us anyway.
I've seen it reported that despite the vast sums that you mentioned, the defense spending at the moment is only about 5% of GNP, which is roughly what it was during the Reagan years. It hasn't gone up that much.
It fluctuates. I tried to discuss it in some ways. There's been four great peaks of defense spending. One is right now. But it never goes below a Cold War norm of approximately $350 billion a year. And it is an argument question, can we afford this level of expenditure? We don't manufacture much in America anymore. We are in our 25th month of recovery that has produced almost no jobs. It's unprecedented in American economic history. The new group of 20 that emerged at the World Trade Organization meeting in Cancun, in the Mexican resort town last autumn, which is opposing us, directly opposing our economic policies for the rest of the world. My argument is that I don't think we can just afford anything. One of the reasons I say this is because precisely the precedent of what happened to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapsed for three basic reasons. Because of extreme ideological rigidity in their domestic economic institutions, making it very hard to reform them. The influence, the power of Stalinism, even though many people in the leadership were aware that it no longer made any sense. Do we have that in America? Well, that's what Enron, what the looting of pension funds, what Martha Stewart, corruption in the mutual fund industry, the distrust of the New York Stock Exchange. That's what that's all about. It shows the same thing. The second thing that brought down the Soviet Union was imperial overstretch. That is, they simply couldn't continue to afford to meet us everywhere on Earth. Well, what is imperial overstretch? I'd say 725 military bases in other people's countries is about as good a definition of imperial overstretch as I could think of. And finally, inability to reform. You see, as a professor of international relations, we usually argue that no empire ever gives up voluntarily. I can think of one exception to it, one case that came pretty close to being an empire that gave up voluntarily, and that was the Soviet Union under Mikhail Gorbachev. He made the decision that Russia would be better off with friendly relations with France and Germany than with these crummy East European satellites that they'd kept since 1945, and therefore he did not use the Red Army against the protesters who in November 1989 breached the Berlin Wall. But my point is, Gorbachev was then stopped cold by vested interests in the Soviet system. He couldn't get around it. Now, do I think those vested interests exist in the United States? Well, to ask the question is to answer it. That is the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us against. That is among the best ways to get rich in America, if you're a politically well-connected capitalist, is in the arms industry, is in the service of the armed forces. Of the $57 billion just appropriated for Iraq, a good third of it is going into private hands to maintain the armed forces in the field. The private military companies today do everything but pull the trigger. My argument is that we have to be careful about whether we can afford these things just endlessly, indefinitely. I think history suggests to us that we can't. It reminds me once that Paul Kennedy, who wrote the important book called The Rise and Decline of Great Powers, he once said as he was traveling, he's a professor at Yale, but an Englishman, in traveling in America, people used to stand up and say to him, "Professor Kennedy, are you really saying that the decline of the United States is inevitable?" And he'd say, "No, I'm not saying that. It's just simply I can't think of the evidence for the opposite point of view. I mean, I can't think of what body of evidence you care to offer a halfway intelligent person that the United States goes on forever like it was Apollo or something."
As you said in the prologue, this is not an optimistic report. There are a lot of questions that I would like to ask, but I'm sure there are questions that you would like to ask, and let me give you an opportunity to do that. Yes, the lady with the black and white sweater. Did everybody hear that question? What happens? How does it end? Will it be a happy end? I guess is really the question that's being asked.
Soft landing, I think they often say, and things like. History would suggest to us that they are not soft landings; that they come out rather badly. That is what one would advocate. Senator Byrd, in his heart, obviously believes and says so, that the American public, when finally fully informed, will reassert their democratic control and reestablish their republic, revolt against the people who have been cheating them. I'm not at all certain that that's true, or they can even possibly get the information to do so, given the control of the media and things like that. Those of us who are opposed to the war party, well, we have on our side the Internet, the Nation magazine, Paul Krugman, a few others. But that's one of the things that makes the difference, is that we're reading things like antiwar.com every morning. It's a gazette of information around the world on where these things sit. But how would it, that is to say, what we're advocating is a return to constitutional foreign policy, a return to a reinvigoration of the Congress as genuine representatives of the people. This might require an almost total recasting of the states in this country because of our electoral districts simply are incoherent today in terms of the population and the needs of the country. It would mean a reliance on the demonstration effects of the United States. We used to hold ourselves up as a model for the rest of the world. It would certainly mean a return to that line in the Declaration of Independence that says we seek the good respect of the rest of mankind. We don't seem to do that any longer. And things like that that are common knowledge and fairly sensible, and that certainly a reliance on trade as a form of mutually beneficial activity, not a way to screw Mexican farmers, which is what it is pretty much today. But how it actually will end, I think, is that history would tell us it's much more likely to end in a severe crack-up, just as it did, for example, in the case of the Soviet Union, as we waste our resources in the military. Certainly, one of the things it would require is one of my criticisms of the Democratic Party at the present time. I appreciate Howard Dean's raising of these issues because I do believe that the Constitution was the issue. But no Democrat has yet even begun to set out for us what we need in the way of a military to protect the country. Militarism is not the same thing as national defense. No one opposes national defense. Militarism is the glorification of, profiting from, the military as a way of life. And it is, I mean, right now, the amount of money spent by the United States on foreign affairs, 93% of it is spent by the Pentagon, 7% by the State Department. That's where our priorities are at the present time. It would mean an altering of those priorities. It would mean the kind of demobilization that the United States experienced very rapidly after World War II, a reorientation of the society to civilian pursuits. Do I think that's possible? I doubt it. I mean, so often when questions like yours get asked to me by somebody who says, well, what do you think we should do? My wife says, you must say something other than this, but I have on one or two occasions said, if you've got a little money ahead, think about a condo in Vancouver. Think about your escape route is my most serious advice. And look around and see if you have the ability of acquiring any other kind of passport. A second passport is occasionally quite useful thing in this world Greece is one of the most anti-American countries on earth. They remember the Greek colonels. We put them in power between 1967 and 1973, probably the most odious regime created by either side in the Cold War. If you're thinking of going to the Olympic Games in Greece, brought back to Greece this coming summer, and you've got a French passport or a Brazilian passport, it would be just elementary prudence to use it.
They may not have the stadiums ready by the time the Olympics are held. Yes, up in the back. Go ahead. The question is about the secret bases allegedly in Israel. What are they for, and are the American soldiers there dressed in uniforms?
We are not sure. These have been reported, but much
where
of
have they been reported?
They've been in things like the London Review of Books details. I mean, we get information on the secret bases in England from a very interesting woman. I'd like to offer her some credit here, Lindis Percy of the Committee for Nuclear Disarmament. She spends her time breaking into American military bases. She is charged to demonstrate what goes on there. She is then invariably charged with criminal trespass, and as she goes to court, the U.S. Embassy drops all charges because to pursue the case gives her a chance to say what she found. She was last seen brilliantly nailing or attaching an American flag upside down to the gates of Buckingham Palace during the visit of the boy emperor this past autumn.
What's your evidence, though, for the bases in Israel?
Journalists who know a good deal about what these bases look like, they're undercover for maintaining peace on the Egyptian border in the Negev. But the entire flight, the aircraft off the USS Eisenhower were flown off into a base in Israel. They're widely discussed in Haaretz, in Jerusalem. It's in the papers in Tel Aviv. But I don't know much more than that, except that they're there, that they are included in our plans. The Global Security Organization tries to track them, but every bit of information you get is from other than official sources.
Yes, sir.
Thinking about the oligarchy and the dynamic with the military, you've got me thinking when you talk about how our people refuse to implement any form of conservation. And I guess this is really a chicken and egg kind of question. Which is justifying which? Is the military presence to support our oil consumption, or is it really vice versa?
Well, I don't think...
Anybody heard that one?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Beg your pardon.
Is the military... Which military occupation are you talking about?
I'm talking about how he says that our entire empire is there because to support our
in part
of oil. Right. The question is whether or not the oil, that's the case, or whether or not we're using the massive consumption to justify the extension of the empire.
Okay. Everybody got that one. Go ahead.
I think it's a perfectly good question, and it's a thing you'd have to argue. I mean, it would run one way, it can run both ways, that indeed our consumption of fossil fuels turns into something called our way of life, and if that's what that is our way of life, then that's what our army is supposed to defend. At the same time, the military often finds that it wishes to control. I mean, resource diplomacy is as old an issue in international relations as one could find, and they're controlling a valuable resource. My reason for raising the issue of conservation: we know how to deal with terrorist incidents. We have a great deal of experience in this area, and it's not mysterious. You do not use high-tech military to go in and kick down doors and holler peace and freedom in English to a group of Arabic speakers. That's what the terrorists anticipate, is a military overreaction that will make the situation worse. And it's arguably worse. That is, between 1993 and 2001, including 9/11, al-Qaeda carried out 5 major bombings worldwide. Since that time, in 2 years, down to and including the suicide attacks in Istanbul against the HSBC Bank and against the British consulate, they successfully carried out 17. In the cold, hard slog, long, hard slog memo of Secretary Rumsfeld last October, he said, we don't have a metric, he means measure, we don't have a measure for whether we're winning or losing the war on terrorism. We certainly do have a measure. We're losing it, we've played directly into their hands. But I raise this to say, the only way to go about it is to separate the activists from their passive supporters so that the passive supporters, will then supply you with information on who the terrorists are so that they can be apprehended, arrested, and brought to trial. The only way you can separate them from these active supporters, separate their passive populations, is by responding to their legitimate grievances, by alteration of your foreign policy. I believe that after 9/11, had we instantaneously done 3 things, withdrawn our troops from Saudi Arabia that never should have been put there in 1991 anyway, and which we did take them out the moment we had defeated Baghdad, it would have made a difference. That we should have also recognized that as a matter of national policy, we in the United States stand for the ultimate security of Israel, but that the policies of the Sharon government against the Palestinians are actually made it impossible to have us trusted in any Islamic country on earth, and in fact are adding very greatly to the long-range dangers to Israel. I believe that we should have stopped the $3 billion of Pentagon money per annum to Israel until they withdrew from the occupied territories in the West Bank. I mean, Israel is not a small country. It has the largest fleet of F-16s on earth other than the United States. It is an atomic power. It is easily the most powerful country in the Middle East. I believe this would have made a difference. And then third, had we then begun to eliminate the leverage of the oil countries like Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran on us by freeing ourselves from the dependence on petroleum for our automotive industry, this would have had added an element of credibility to what we were doing. I believe had we done these three things, Al-Qaeda would be of interest primarily to chiefs of police today, and we would be well on our way toward rounding them up. The French and the Germans have already, and the Spaniards have done a wonderful job of rounding up these activists in Western Europe already.
Go over here. Yes, sir. Gentleman is asking what happens when we run out of oil, basically.
When we run out of cheap oil.
Yeah, cheap oil. You're absolutely right. It's not rocket science to say that that's what's happening. It's why Toyota is working day and night on a post-petroleum automobile, whereas we are not. It is why we have to face the fact that though Iraq was attractive to us because it has the second largest oil reserves on Earth, still the largest on earth are those in Saudi Arabia, and our policies there are virtually asking for an anti-American revolution against the House of Fahd. And, I mean, that is to say, the thing that has ruined our Middle Eastern policy, it was built on two pillars, our relations with Saudi Arabia, our relations with Iran. The Iranian pillar fell in 1979 when the Shah was overthrown because of our history of interfering in Iranian politics. We are now worried that this could happen in Saudi Arabia, but as you just made the case, Saudi Arabia has, its reserves are so large that a country that uses as much oil as we do can't do without it, and they're the only country on earth that can produce petroleum at a relatively cheap price and still make it economical, as distinct from exporting oil from, say, the Caspian Basin, where the Caspian Sea is totally landlocked, you've got really difficult chores of getting it out and taking it through places like Chechnya, Dagestan, or Kurdistan, Turkey, are places that are just wildly open to sabotage. So that, yes, of course, I regard it as short-term and not very well thought through to think that you can perpetuate our elaborate use of fossil fuels indefinitely. Also, in order to do that, we had to simply ignore the growing evidence of global warming, withdrawn from the international efforts to control greenhouse gases, which has, again, it's not just that this was a mistake, it also conveyed to the rest of the world that the United States had abandoned its historic efforts, for which I think we ought to be enormously proud, since World War II, to build an edifice of international law, of the United Nations, of organizations like the International Criminal Court, which we signed the original treaty, and then we have now denounced it. The Kyoto Protocol was not perfect, without question, but we then just denounced it and walked away from it. The other industrial nations spent their times trying to modify it in such a way that it made it a little bit easier on the advanced industrial countries, and then have tried to put it into effect. It's our pulling out of that conveys that we're simply no longer a good citizen. We're not cooperative. And I'm sorry to say there will be an awful lot of people around the world who, when the American empire goes down, they will feel as bad about it as they did when the Soviet empire went down.
I think we have time for just one more question. Yes, right here.
In 1972, when sins out there and having him pay. Is it possible that George Bush will come to the same kind of situation, or has the conglomeratization of the media made that kind of situation impossible? And for example, would Daniel Ellsberg be able to get the Pentagon Papers out today?
Question is, would, given the fate of Richard Nixon, who was elected overwhelmingly and reelected in 1972, only to resign shortly thereafter, could the same kind of thing happen to the current president?
The only prophet who was ever any good was Cassandra. She was, she has a wonderful record. Beware of Greeks bearing gifts, and there was something in that horse that you should pay attention to. I am obviously not as clear-sighted as Cassandra. I don't know the answer to that question, but I am inclined to argue that the fate of individuals is less important here than the fate of institutions, of a re-education of Americans to their democratic heritage, to the understanding of what it means when our original founding fathers said that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. This, during the 1990s, when we were spending our time trying to impeach a present resident because of an alleged love affair that should only have been of interest probably to his wife, we are beginning to, I mean, what does worry me is the thought that the views of a lot of people on 9/11 around the world, the Americans had it coming, that we are asking for it, that we are displaying hubris, arrogance, pride. Nemesis is the goddess of vengeance, of the retribution of people who behave as we do. I end my book by saying, I have the distinct feeling that Nemesis is waiting impatiently for her meeting with us.
We are going to leave it at that. The Sorrows of Empire, Chalmers Johnson. He'll be signing books outside. Thanks to the Library Foundation and all of you for being here today.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.